So it's all here. The story of our time with the bar call.
That was President Lyndon Baines Johnson upon the dedication of his presidential library in 1971. Since then, the library has played host to the biggest names and best minds of our day, who have helped to tell the story of our times through candid, revealing conversations with the Barkoff. This podcast delivers them straight to you. Welcome to With the Barkoff. I'm Mark Updegrove.
Good evening. Today, our fellow citizens, our way of life, our very freedom came under attack in a series of deliberate and deadly terrorist acts. The victims were in airplanes or in their offices, secretaries, businessmen and women, military and federal workers, moms and dads, friends and neighbors. Thousands of lives were suddenly ended by evil, despicable acts of terror. These acts of mass murder were intended to frighten our nation into chaos and retreat. But they have failed. Our country is strong. A great people has been moved to defend a great nation. Terrorist attacks can shake the foundations of our biggest buildings, but they cannot touch the foundation of America. These acts shatter steel, but they cannot dent the steel of American resolve.
That was our 43rd president, George W. Bush, addressing the nation on the evening of September 11, 2001. The 20th anniversary of the attacks on 9/11 is a time for reflection for many Americans. Most of us remember indelibly where we were when the attacks on our homeland changed the course of our history. In this episode of With the Barkoff, we draw on an LBJ library program titled A White House View of 9/11, with three pivotal members of the Bush administration who have their own unique perspectives on that fateful day. Karen Hughes served as White House Communications Director, Clay Johnson as Assistant Director for Presidential Personnel, and Karl Rove as Senior Advisor to the President. Each reflected their personal experiences and what it was like to be with the President of the United States on 9/11 and in the critical days immediately afterward. I started with Karl, who was traveling with President Bush in Sarasota, Florida, where the president was attending an event at Emma Booker Elementary School around his No Child Left Behind education initiative.
I remember that morning we got up early, the president went running, and it was a very bright and wonderful day. I mean, it was just picture-perfect weather. And we went to the elementary school, Emma Booker Elementary School, and about 8:48 my phone rang. And it was my assistant, Susan Ralston, who said a plane's flown into the World Trade Center. We don't know whether it's jet or prop, commercial or private. And the president was about 10, 15 feet away, shaking hands with administrators and teachers. And so I went over and told him. And he had a funny look on his face and said, get more details. About a couple minutes later, Condi called and had the same sketchy information. And he went into the classroom. He was a reading demonstration promoting No Child Left Behind, this signature education legislation. And I had to go scurry up a TV because there was not a TV that worked in the staff hold. There's wherever the president travels, there's always a room nearby called the staff hold where they, a couple of days beforehand, they show up with big boxes and unpacked, you saw the picture in Eric of a black telephone unit. I mean, you push O on that button and some guy under Cheyenne Mountain, Colorado answers, and a minute later you can be talking to anybody anywhere in the world. And they guard him until about 20 minutes after the president departs, and then they take him back. But that day the staff hold had the phones, but they didn't have a television set. So I spent the opening moments of the War on Terror by stealing a television set from a nearby classroom. And I remember I had to plug it into the power unit, but I also had to plug it into the wall to get a signal, cable TV. And the first hole I plugged it into didn't work. The second one I plugged it into, it went pop. I'm lying on the ground doing this in a suit, and it goes pop. And it comes on, and the voices are saying, what did we just see? What did we just see? And that was the second plane flying into the World Trade Center. Andy Card, the chief of staff, determined that he needed to go tell the president. And Clay and I were, and you were recently with Andy and at another major Texas university whose name will go unmentioned, A&M. And I remember at the time, Andy walked over to the door separating the staff hold from the classroom, and he hesitated. And this was a moment where, you know, time is moving rather rapidly, and for Andy to go stand at the door, I mean, it was like eternity. I'm sure it was only a couple of seconds. But I never knew why until the three of us were together and heard Andy explain that he was trying to collect his thoughts so that he could walk in and tell the president what he needed to know in a way that the president would not feel compelled to ask a question. Because the president had 30 or 40 press with cameras and tape recorders and a room full of, you know, fourth and fifth graders and educators and administrators, and this was not a moment where, you know, there needed to be a discombobulation. So Andy went in and told the president a second plane has flown into the World Trade Center, America is under attack, and stepped back. The president had to make a decision what to do, and, you know, this reading demonstration was rolling to a close, so he decided rather than to jump up and run out of the room, he'd wait until it finished. So it was another 4 minutes or 5 minutes before he emerged into the room. And in the interim, the tension inside the staff hold had sort of grown. I mean, this is a first-rate group of people there. You saw some of them, Harriet Myers, then Major Tom Gould of the Air Force, Major Paul Montana of the Marines, and senior staff of the president. But there was palpable tension and anxiety in the room because we're watching what the rest of America is watching. And I'll never forget it. Bush came into the room, and he was unnaturally calm and cold almost. And he said, we're at war, get me the director of the FBI and the vice president. And there was a sense of steel in his voice that was unnaturally calming as well for us all. So we jumped on the phones and began to call. This is the moment at which the vice president is being grabbed by a couple of Secret Service agents and literally carried down the hallway in the West Wing to the secret entrance to the PEOC, the President's Emergency Operations Center, underneath the South Lawn. And we can't get him, but we get Mueller, and we start talking to other people. The president, as you saw, was writing a statement. What you didn't see was that he wrote most of the statement sitting in a little chair made for kindergartners at a table made for fourth graders. Most of the adult furniture had been taken out of the room, and he's sitting there scribbling this statement, which gave about a minute to give. And as he was getting to the end of scribbling out what he wanted to say, and he was talking with Dan Bartlett, Karen's deputy, and Ari Fleischer and me, Eddie Marenzel, who is the Secret Service guy with the incredibly bad ties, came over and said to the president, he said, Mr. President, we need to get you to the airport and airborne as quickly as possible. They were worried that this was, the president's whereabouts was known, and they were worried that this was an effort to decapitate the government, and that someone might fly an airplane into the Emma Booker Elementary School, or there might be a you know, suicide bomber nearby. So the president made a statement. We went and we got in the limo. We got in the car. I normally didn't ride with the president in the limo, but that day sort of said and pointed to the stagecoach, which was then the code name for the limousine. And I got in with him, and we went off to the airport. Now, presidential motorcades generally go about 40, 45 miles an hour. We were going like bat out of hell at about 85 miles an hour. And during the course of the ride to the airport, the president got the phone call about the strike on the Pentagon. Now, I can only hear one side of the conversation, but when the opening words are, is Rumsfeld alive? That was the first thing the president said in response to it. You know, that ain't good news. And I remember being so, I mean, when I heard that, I just had to look away from the president. And so I looked out the window of the car, and I realized that if I could roll down the window of stagecoach, that about a foot away from the car, matching our speed, 80, 85 miles an hour, was a police car. And I realized suddenly that there was one on every side of the car, which is, you know, I'd never seen it before and never saw it again. When we got to the airport later in the day, I said to Eddie Marenzel, I said, Eddie, what was that all about? And he said, we were worried that a suicide bomber might nearby by, a truck bomb or a car bomb, and so we wanted to improve the president's chances of survivability, give him an extra foot or two more for the blast to go off. So we surrounded the car with the hope that they'd block any suicide attack on the stagecoach. Which, you know, sort of horrifying. Later on, I got to thinking, what the hell was I doing in that car with him? But
human shield.
Sometimes the decoys in Kosovo.
Yeah. Karen and I was once the decoys in Kosovo when the president flew into an airport controlled by the Russians. We were in a little airplane and they flew us in ahead of the president. The president was out there orbiting and we're going in for the airport and we said to the guy who's manning the radar console, "What the heck's going on?" He said, "We're trying to see if we can draw any fire." Well, that was my day to draw fire. So. But we got to the airport, and there's a certain ceremony for any president when they get to mount up the steps of Air Force One. I'm sure you've seen it on television. They have, there's a group of people at the bottom of the stairs who say goodbye to the president, local dignitaries, and then the president mounts the stairs and gets to the top of the stairs and turns around and waves to the crowd. Most of the time, many times, there's no crowd, but they're always television cameras, so pretend there is a crowd. So wave to the crowd. The president goes onto the plane, and then a minute or two later, they allow the staff to get on the plane, and 10 or 15 minutes later, they rev up the engines and button the plane up, and it takes off. Well, I'm standing at the bottom of the stairs. I remember Eddie Morenzo was standing with his foot on the lower step, and I was standing at the bottom of the stairs, and the president got about halfway, two-thirds of the way up, and Eddie turned to me. You could tell something went off in his earpiece, and he turned to me and said, "Go." And he didn't mean meander, he meant go. And so I started running up the stairs and colleagues started running up behind. And I got about halfway up the stairs of Air Force One and looked over to my right, and underneath the wing, they were making the press discard all of their equipment, their cameras, their tape recorders, their computers, their laptops, their bags, and they had a bomb dog going over them. And they were making the press go onto the plane with nothing but what was on their person, and to check and see if somebody was trying to smuggle a bomb on board. And as they cleared equipment, they just went over and threw it into the bottom of Air Force One. So I got up to the top of the steps, and Air Force One's a 747, and you get on, and very few people go to the left. To the left is that room that Eric showed you, with the bed and the head and the shower and couch where the president and Andy were having their discussion. Everybody turns to the right, and the first door is the president's private cabin, and the next door is the steps up to the cockpit, and then there's a medical unit, a galley, and then there's the senior staff cabin where Karen and Clay and I would hang out when we were on trips, and then there's a conference room, and then the seating for other people. I was on my way to the senior staff cabin, and I didn't get there because the president again whistled and motioned to sit across the chair from him in his private cabin. And, I sort of sat down and sort of got ready but I noticed it was really noisy. The engines were already revved up, and normally you never heard them because they'd button up the plane and then turn on, but the engines were already up and people were running onto the plane and down the hallway, and then they stopped because they'd all entered and the engines were revved up and we started moving. All of a sudden, the stairs disappeared. They're on the back of a truck. I think they're on the back of a truck, and bang, they were gone. And the door is open, and we're moving. And I remember an airman comes running up the hallway of Air Force One and grabs a strap and leans out over 20 feet of air and grabs the door and pulls it shut and arms the door. And we're moving down the runway. I mean, we are moving. And we get to the end of the runway, and Colonel Tillman flips this plane around like it is a Cessna. I mean, just literally flips this big 747, guns the engines, and you can just hear the plane vibrating, and then let's go. And we go rocketing down the runway, and we get airborne, and that plane stands on its tail. And I'm sitting in the chair across from the president looking up at him, trying to be like, okay, everything's okay. Because they thought some guy might have a man pad, a shoulder-launched missile lying in wait at the end of the runway, and they wanted to get airborne as quickly as possible. So we did. And then we had this conversation. You saw the gentle parts of it. The president said, "I'm going back to Washington." And Cheney said no. Rumsfeld said no. Secret Service said, "Mr. President, we can't guarantee the airspace over Washington." Andy Card said no. And the president kept saying, "I'm going to Washington." And Clay's known the president longer than any of us, and he's not an angry guy. But he came pretty close to being angry. I remember at one point he snapped at Eddie Morenzel, who came in to make the argument. He said, He cut him off saying, Eddie, you tell Andy if he wants to make that argument to me again, come make it himself. And another point, Andy did make the argument, and he cut him off saying, I am the president. Like Andy needed to be reminded of that.
The first thing he said to me that day was, don't you think I need to get back there? And I said, yes, sir, I do. And he said, well, I'm coming next time. I'm not letting them keep me away anymore.
Yeah. Well, the guy who finally figured it out was Tom Gould, who was the Air Force officer. And he said, Mr. President, we don't have a full fuel load. We have too many people on board. We don't have a full fuel load. We get back to Washington, and we're not able to land. We won't be able to orbit long enough. So we need to go to a nearby secure facility, drop unnecessary personnel, get a full fuel load, and then we can go to Washington. So if we can't land, then we can orbit. And it sounded good.
Where'd that one come from?
Yeah, but that was clearly a dodge because we're at this point over the northeast part of Florida, over near Cape Canaveral, and we got Naval Air Station Jacksonville north of us, and we got Eglin Air Force Base slightly to the west of us. And they say, Mr. President, the most secure facility is Barksdale Air Force Base, the headquarters of the 8th Air Force in northwestern Louisiana. And the reason was it was on not lockdown from the day before. There'd been a nuclear test drill, and so the entire base was already on lockdown and completely secure. So we land there, and Eric's right. We catch the signal. The local television station had sent a camera crew on the flight path into Barksdale, and they were the first people to know where we were. Nobody knows in America where we were except the local CBS affiliate in Shreveport, Louisiana. So much for security. And we land, and I remember, you know, landing at a military installation with any president is pretty amazing. You know, flags, music, snappy salutes, uniforms, you know, brass. I mean, it's really impressive. Not that day. We got off in the command structure. The 8th Air Force was there in their combat uniforms, every one of them with a sidearm. And I haven't seen that many guns since the South Texas hunting party. I mean, it was, everybody had a weapon. And I have to correct Eric, the president did not ride in a Humvee. The Humvee was the security vehicle. The president rode in a powder blue Dodge mini caravan, which is not very presidential. But there was an armed Humvee right behind him with a 50 caliber machine gun on top, and the place is deadly silent. And when the president's car begins to move, the airman manning the 50 cal puts a live round in the chamber.
But Clay, you were in the White House that morning. Mm-hmm. Talk about the morning of 9/11 from your perspective.
Okay. There's a senior staff meeting at 7:30, and so get there at 7 or so, go down to the Roosevelt Room, 7:30, meeting over at 8. I had an appointment at my office on the second floor of the West Wing, and at 9 I was supposed to go down and see Tim Flanagan, who's the Deputy White House Counsel, to talk about some appointments matter. And as I was walking out of my office about a few minutes before 9, the assistant sat there. There was a TV in the corner, and they show the World Trade Towers and smoke coming out. I said, what's that? And they said, some private plane flew into the World Trade Towers. I said, God, that awful, wow. Down the hall, Flynn Flanagan, there were three or four of us in the meeting. At 9, whatever time, the second plane flew in, 9:13 or something.
9:03.
So about 9:10, the woman comes in, but his assistant comes in, hands him a note. He looks at it and says, another one? Hands him back the note. The rest of us are. And what is it? And he said, a second plane. Then about that time, the assistant comes in and said, we've been asked to go, all of us, don't go back to your office, go downstairs to the White House mess, which is on the lower floor, which is the lowest large space in the White House, and gather there. And I did stop long enough. I called Ann and said, turn on the TV. Hung up. So we're down there. Couldn't have been more than 5 minutes. Someone comes in and says, everybody, women, take off your heels. Everybody, leave the North Gate, go across to the other side of Lafayette Square. Don't tell you what to do. Just go to the north side and go over there. And they said, go fast, as fast as you can go. So we do that, and then we're over there, and now what? Now what do we do? And Anita McBride, who's Laura's chief of staff, was chief of staff, said, my husband works over here, Daimler Chrysler, the office is about four blocks, lots of spare rooms, let's go over there. So bunch of people went over there, probably 30 or 40, and it grew to probably double that in the morning. And we were over there. Nick Callio, who's a legislative affairs assistant to the president, me, Anita, we over there and watching on televisions, and we're just stunned like everybody else in America was. So that's what was going on until about noon when we came back, and we'll cover that when you go to the next phase.
Now, Karen, you were neither with the president nor at the White House, but like many of us, you were at home.
Very unusual. Almost any other morning of my entire time at the White House, I would have been either with the president or at the White House. But September 10th is my wedding anniversary. And so I had decided to stay in Washington with my husband so we could have an anniversary dinner. We'd never missed an anniversary before. And my deputy traveled to Florida with the president. And so when it became clear that I wasn't going to Florida, Mel Martinez, the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, asked me to represent the White House at a Habitat for Humanity event that morning. And it was going to be a build, and so we were supposed to wear your blue jeans and your T-shirt. And President Bush, out of respect for the office, didn't allow blue jeans in the West Wing. So I had taken the opportunity to sleep a little late and missed that 7:30 horrible senior staff meeting. And I was literally I was supposed to be at the Habitat event at 9:30, and so I was just stepping out of the shower when the phone rang. And it was my assistant at the White House who told my husband, will you tell Karen that a plane has hit the World Trade Center? Well, my husband knows me well enough to know that something like that would just prompt a whole host of questions that he couldn't answer. So he said, you better tell her yourself, and took the phone to the shower and handed it to me as I was stepping out. And so, you know, my mind was small plane, heart attack, terrible accident. I said to my assistant, have you called Dan, who was my deputy with the president? And she said, I just did before I called you. And so I hung up the phone and called Dan, and who was with the president in the room where you saw the pictures with Eric. I turned on the television, and as I did, saw the second plane hit the second tower. And I remember my first instinct was to drop to my knees and say a prayer for the people in the building. And somebody later asked me, why not the people on the airplane? It never occurred to me there were people on the airplane. I mean, it was just too horrific. So I immediately called Dan, and I said, Dan, a second plane has hit the second tower. And so that's when he pointed at the TV for all of you all in Florida. I called Dan and said, a second plane has hit the second tower. And I'll never forget this question because it struck me as such a guy kind of question. He said, what kind of plane? And I said, I don't know. I said, a big plane like a passenger plane. Never again occurring to me that it was in fact a passenger plane. And so I then spent the next, I was on the phone with Dan. We agreed that the president had to make a statement. I thought when they left Florida that they were coming back to Washington. I was not aware that the vice president and Andy had recommended that he not come back. Dan and I were planning through, he's got to call the mayor of New York, he's got to call the governor, we've got to activate the federal emergency response, and I knew I had to get to the White House. And finally, I got a number and called, and the vice president said, I need you to call the plane. They're on the way to Louisiana, and they're going to make a statement. They're working on a statement. And he indicated, there was something that he said that indicated to me he didn't think he liked it or I would like it. And so I called the plane, I got a hold of Ari, I asked Ari to read me the statement. And the first line said, America today was the victim of. And I just had this horrible reaction. I was like, we are not victims. Our country, we may have been attacked, but our country is not a victim. And so we were working on the statement and, you know, talking the whole time. And finally, when I talked to the vice president, he had said he would send a military driver to bring me back to downtown Washington. And it seemed like it took forever. The traffic was horrible in Washington, as you can imagine. The driver got me. I went back into downtown Washington. And, you know, as you can imagine, mine was the only car headed that way. Everybody else was fleeing the city. I could see the Pentagon burning over the driver, and I realized as I'm sitting there that he must have very good friends there. And I said to him, I'm sure you have a lot of friends there. This is a horrible day for our country. And he said, yes, ma'am. And, you know, it was just sort of silence. There was a lighthearted moment. We got to the first perimeter checkpoint, and the military driver said to the guard, who came up very suspiciously with his gun pointed at the car, because they were worried about suicide bombers, the military driver said, I have Karen Hughes, and I'm taking her to the vice president. And I heard the guy wasn't about to let me through. He radioed his supervisor, his supervisor, I heard him come back and say, how do you know it's Karen Hughes? Are you sure it's Karen Hughes? And the officer looked in the car and said, yep, I've seen her on TV. So a rare light-hearted moment that day. I finally get to the White House after several more checkpoints, and they dropped me off at the east side, which is not where we usually went in. We went in the west side, and nobody was there. And so I said to the driver, what do I do? And he said, well, go in and they'll take you to wherever you're supposed to go. Well, I'd never seen, if the president's there, the Marine is always standing guard at the door. There's always somebody there. I walked in, there's nobody there. There's no receptionist, there's nobody. And I thought, well, you know, this is not a good day to be sneaking into the White House. And so I sort of yelled, hello, is anybody here? You know, I didn't know what to do. And I hear these heavy footsteps, guys running down the hall, and their weapons are drawn as I walk into the door and yell, is anybody here? Explained who I was. They led me through a series of of tunnels and facilities to get to the Emergency Operations Center. And each one, it's like a submarine door closing, you know, the pressurized sense, you get the feeling. And I got to the Presidential Operations Center, and when I walked in, what immediately struck me was, in contrast to the chaos that I'd been watching on television and hearing in the news reporting, it was completely calm. The vice president was on the phone. The Secretary of Transportation, Norm Mineta, was on the phone. They were talking to the president. They were grounding the planes. They were activating the emergency response. They were putting the embassies on alert. You know, they were sending rescue teams to New York. And my immediate thought, again, as a communicator was, I've got to communicate this to the public. I've got to explain to people what I'm seeing here. And so the Secret Service, though, wouldn't let me brief from the White House briefing room. They thought it was too dangerous. So they literally surrounded me, five agents or six, around me like a human, like a shield, with their guns drawn, and they walked me out of the White House into a car and took me to the Justice Department. And I'd never had anything like that happen before. I remember as I prepared the statement, and one other little detail about the statement, there was a computer in the bunker. And so I was writing my statement on the computer, and it wasn't until I came time to print the statement out that I realized that this printer probably hadn't been used since, you know, the 1960s or something. Maybe the Cuban Missile Crisis, I don't know. But it barely printed. It was like barely legible. And so I still have a copy of it. The original's in the archives, but a copy of the statement, you can barely read it because there was almost no ink in the printer in the bunker. But I remember feeling a huge responsibility to try to be calm and decisive and in command, you know, for a badly shaken country. So I think that was probably the hardest thing I've ever done in my professional career. We had discussed it and decided that I couldn't take questions. And of course, we knew that would make the media really mad because they hated not to be able to ask questions. But all the information that we had confidence in was in my statement. And we knew that my inability to answer, the first question would be, who did this? And I couldn't answer it at that point. And my inability to answer would be detrimental to our mission to try to reassure people and instill a sense of calm.
Right. Carl, let's go back to Barksdale Air Force Base in Louisiana. President Bush, when he talks or writes about 9/11, talks about the fog of war that he was experiencing. Can you talk a little bit about what was happening at that base and what the president was feeling and experiencing?
Yeah, well, there is a fog of war, and Karen and Clay alluded to it. There was the report about the attack on the State Department with a car bomb. There was this talk of the attack on Angel, and what turned out to have happened was, look, whenever you have an incident, I don't care how big or little it is, there's a nut out there in America who calls the Secret Service and makes a threat. And what had happened is, in the aftermath of the attacks on the World Trade Center, somebody picked up the phone and called and said, the Air Force One is next. And as this got reported up the chain of command, somewhere in the chain of command, somebody invoked Angel. Somebody took the code word, the then code word for Air Force One, and said, the threat is that Angel is next. And this gave it obviously greater credibility than just some nut calling the switchboard saying, you know, I'm going to get the president. But, you know, there is a fog of war. But what got me that day was the clarity of certain things. You know, like Andy and I were sitting there, and the president got a phone call, and we could only hear, obviously, his side of the conversation. And it was Cheney. Didn't know that until afterwards. But the president said, yes. Listen for a while. Yes. Listen for a few moments more. Said, you have my authorization. Yes. Listen for a few more moments and then hung up. And in about as even a tone of voice as a human being can have, he said, I've just given authorization for the military to shoot down any aircraft inbound to a critical target not under the command of its crew. And I remember just sort of like moment of horror. And I think he was chewing a cigar and he said something to the effect, I can't remember the words because it was such an awful moment. He said something about how terrible it would be to be a young pilot to get that order. But there was such clarity about the necessity of it. So yeah, there was a fog of war. When we got to Barksdale, and Karen and Ari and Dan and everybody worked over the statement, and he then gave it. They then said, he said, I'm coming home. I'm coming to Washington. And they said, Mr. President, we can't guarantee the security of the airspace. He said, I'm coming to Washington. They said, Mr. President, we've dispersed the government. Cheney's in the PIOC. Rumsfeld is now secure. FBI director secure. CIA director. All of these people are in secure facilities. The Secretary of State is in South America, Peru. So they said, Mr. President, if we can fly you to Offutt Air Force Base, we have facilities there that allow us to link everybody together by secure video conference. It's the nearest facility. We can't do it at Barksdale. We can do it at Offutt. So, Mr. President, how about if you fly to Offutt? It's an hour and 15 minutes away, closer than Washington, and then you can be briefed by everybody. We'd had a briefing there. Eric had the picture of it, and there was a video link, but you had to be in one of those facilities. If you look closely at that photograph, there's not very many important people in those facilities. Today, President Obama travels with a Halliburton case that's about this size and about this deep, and he can plug it into any internet outlet, any cable TV outlet, and have a secure video conference with a number of people simultaneously all around the world. But back then, the technology was such that this was the closest we could go, so we fly to Offutt. And the president is steaming, and he said, look, I know this is just a dodge. This is the last time that they're going to be able to pull this off. So we get to Offutt, and we land at Offutt, which is a Cold War, headquarters of SAC, and it's got these impossibly long runways. They look like, concrete roads, that go on for miles. And so the Air Force One goes off to this corner of the field away from any building, except there's like what looks like a telephone equipment shed right there. And we get off the plane and we go over to the telephone equipment shed, which is about the size of, for one person to walk into to work on your phone equipment. And we walk in and go down about 300, 400 feet into this facility designed to withstand a nuclear blast way under the Omaha Prairie, Nebraska Prairie. And we walk in and it's like out of Dr. Strangelove. We walk in and there's like this three-story electronic board, and we're up here, and the president then goes down to the floor of this facility, and they have this gigantic board, and they then link him in, and then they describe what's going on. And this is the fog of war. Seven aircraft inbound over the Atlantic with their transponders not squawking, thought to be under the control of hijackers. One is 30 minutes outside of Philadelphia, and has been aircraft have been scrambled, and if they can't divert the aircraft off of the New Jersey coast, they have orders to shoot it down. There's supposedly a aircraft on the tarmac in Yellowknife in the Yukon Territory under the control of hijackers, and Canadian Special Forces are inbound to retake control of the plane. And of course, none of this is true. But this is also the first time where Al-Qaeda is mentioned by George Tenet. Very strong suggestion that Al-Qaeda is behind this, given the 1993 bombings. And so they finish, and the president says, I'm coming home. And they say the same old arguments again, and the president says he's had enough of it. And he says, basically, I have confidence in you. Do your best. But the nation needs to hear from me from the Oval Office, not from some bunker underneath, the prairies of Nebraska. And he was pretty blunt about it. But I thought it was interesting that he started off by saying, do your best. I have confidence in you. typical Bush style. Mm-hmm. So we got back into Washington, and they were still nervous about the airspace over Washington. So Colonel Tillman brought in Air Force One, and I kid you not, it was the reverse of the takeoff. We're going down like this. I mean, he didn't go like the, we're like this. And again, I'm in the same place. I'm strapped in across from the president, looking down at him, trying to be calm. And at the last minute, Tillman, you know, pancakes this onto the runway. It was the most incredible feat of flying I've ever seen. He just pancakes it onto the runway, and we're safe on the ground at Andrews. So we go to get to on Marine One, and there are actually three Marine Ones. There's Marine One and two other helicopters. They look exactly alike. They're all Sikorsky green helicopters with white tops, and they all take off at roughly the same time out of Andrews. They get to 600, 800, 1,200 feet, and then there's a leisurely ballet of the, you know, sort of like the old peas in the pod, you know, where's the pea, you know? And they have a ballet, this ballet that takes place, and they come into the Washington. It's a very leisurely drive. It's a great way to get to and from the airport, I found. No frequent flyer miles, but easier than finding a parking space. And you're flying in, and then the two break off, and one of them goes to land on the south lawn. But they get up there pretty high, and it's a wonderful view. Well, not that day. We got about 5 feet off the ground in Marine One. And we started making our way off of Andrews Air Force Base by going down the greens on the golf course. And with treetops above us, I mean, we're literally five feet off the ground, and we're weaving our way off the base. And we get to the fence line. Andrews is in the Maryland suburb. So it's surrounded on two, three sides by just suburbs. And we get to the fence line in Marine One, and I'll never forget it. The pilot we're going 20, 30 miles an hour. We get to that fence line, and he just punches it. And we come charging out of that fence line, and I'm sitting, the president is sitting forward-looking and backward-looking chair across from him. I'm sitting on a bench across from him, so I'm looking out the window, and I see out of the fence line 100 yards to the north of it explodes another Sikorsky helicopter just like that right out of the out of the trees. And we're going 160 miles an hour pretty damn quick, and we are in the nap of the earth. We are as close to the ground as you can get, making our way in to Washington by hugging the earth. And at one point, I'm looking out, and there are apartment buildings to the right and houses to the left, and they're above us because we're in this valley, just streaking over the parkway. And at one point, it looks like we're going to go under a bridge, and at the last minute, he pulls it up and over. And I mean, it's exhilarating, but it's scary as hell. And unusual. So we come over the last ridge line separating Maryland from the Potomac. We come up and over, and there's an Air Force base there at Marine Air and Marine Joint Command where they have HMX-1, Marine One. And we come barreling through Bowling Air Force Base at ground level. If there were cars on 295, we would have been knocking out their windows. And we are maneuvering at this high speed through the buildings at Bowling Air Force Base. And we're about ready, it looks like, to land in the Potomac. And at the last second, the pilot pulls a hard right, so hard I can feel the G's in a helicopter. And at that moment, the Pentagon comes into view. It's about 6:30, 6:40 in the evening. And there's smoke pouring out of the Pentagon. And you can see the smoke. And we go through the plume of smoke. Nobody has said a single word the entire flight until that moment. And the president very quietly said, "Take a look. You're looking at the war, at the face of war in the 21st century." And at that, we came up and over the south lawn of the White House, below the Washington Monument. We were below the break between the, you know, the 1834 break between the building it and not building it. We were below that. And we come up and over and land on the south lawn.
Toward the end of our conversation, I talked to Karen Hughes and Carl Rove about September 14th, 3 days after the attacks, when they accompanied President Bush to New York City and toured Ground Zero, the site of the attacks where the felled World Trade Towers had once proudly stood. It was there that President Bush, perched on a pile of rubble with his arm around a firefighter, put a bullhorn to his lips and rallied the nation and the world.
"I can hear you! I can hear you! The rest of the world hears you! And the people... down, we'll hear all of us soon.
USA!
asked Karen what it was like to fly into Manhattan as the city reeled from the recent attacks.
Well, first, I just remember the horror of seeing it. You could still, you know, as our helicopters got closer, you could smell it. It permeated the air, the smell, the horror of the sight. I mean, we'd seen it so much on TV, but somehow just being there, it was so, I loved Eric's description. It was like standing on a raw nerve. It was just the emotion and I emailed a friend when I got home that night and I said that I was struck by three things. First of all, horror. I mean, because being there, you really saw the horror of the situation. And I remember thinking, you know, how could anybody, no matter their training, no matter their zealousness, no matter what they believed, how could they not pull up before flying a plane into that building full of people? And, you know, just in the second emotion was terrible sadness. It was so sad. All the people that had lost loved ones and you could see it, you could feel the visceral anger and sadness at the sight as the workers. We had not planned for the president to speak at Ground Zero because he had given very eloquent remarks earlier the day at the National Prayer Service, and that was supposed to be the remarks for the day. But it became very clear, as Eric said, that people wanted to hear from their president, and it was, there was nothing scripted. It was completely spontaneous on his part.
Yeah, it's actually an accident. It's a complete accident, all due to a woman named Nina Bishop.
Nina Bishop.
Nina Bishop is a White House advance person. She was assigned to State Department. The night before, there had been a meeting of the advance team, and they had decided that there wasn't going to be any remarks because he had this major speech at the National Cathedral. And Nina disagreed. Nina thought the president needed to speak. And so she consciously thought through what member of the president's senior staff was most manipulatable, most malleable, most prone to give in to her idea, and that was me. So we come into the Northwest. We first visited the southeast corner of Ground Zero, and Karen's right. I mean, we were 30 miles south of New York when we entered the plume of smoke. The prevailing wind was from north to south, and you could just smell it. For 30 miles, we had the cabin on Nighthawk 2, which was the chopper that Karen and I were on with Ari Fleischer. It was just a critic. You could just smell it. And we went first to the southwest corner, which is where the facing from the 110th floor of the World Trade Center literally was stabbed into the ground like some gigantic trident. And then we went around in the northwest corner, which was where they were pulling out all of the, you know, all of the rubble. And that's where Nina was. And so we pulled on a little street south, going north to south. The motorcade is only four or five vehicles. And it goes south for a half a block and then turns right. And there's only enough room for two vehicles to turn to the right. And so there are three or four vehicles behind. And I remember when we pulled into this little street, it felt like there was a hum. We were not in normal vehicles. We were in armored SUVs. And so I felt like there was this hum. And I suspect you had the same feeling. When you opened the door, you realized it wasn't a hum. It was the sound of this crowd. And it was unbelievable. It was like you were hit with a wall of sound, and they were chanting USA, USA. And I got out of the vehicle and walked to the front and looked to my left, and there was Cardinal Egan, who's a pal of mine, with the religious leadership of the city of New York, you know, Hasidim Jews, you know, Orthodox, you know, blah, 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 all of them waving U.S. flags and all of them chanting USA. And I mean, it was like completely emotional. And I almost lost it. I mean, because you couldn't look at these men. There was Cardinal Egan weeping. And at that moment, I felt this tug, and I turn around, and it's Nina. And Nina says, they want to hear their president. He needs to speak. And it was a sensible idea. I said, you're right. Do we have a sound system? She said, no. I said, where do you want him to speak from? She said, I don't know. He just needs to speak. What about the running boards? And he, you know, there were wide running boards on these SUVs, but he'd only be this far off the ground. So I said, you go get a bullhorn. Can you get a bullhorn? She said, yeah, I can get one. I said, go get a bullhorn. And I looked around. Before I went to Andy, I wanted to have a place for the president to stand. And I'm not an advanced guy. I don't script well. But I turned around, and there was this fire truck. I remember right below me It said 76 engine company. That was the top of the truck. It had been smashed down, this huge fire truck, so that it was no more than maybe 6 feet tall with a bunch of rubble on top. Three guys standing on top of it. And it's visible to everything. So I wanted to make certain when I went to Andy, I had an idea. So I look up at these three guys, and as I look at them, there are three guys, an old guy, a Latino guy, and an Anglo guy, and the Anglo jumps off the back of the truck. So there are two guys standing on the top of this truck, and I'm sitting there in my suit and tie and buttoned up. And so I look at these guys, and I say, is this thing stable? And they look at me like, you're the man from Mars. And I said, is this thing stable? And the Latino guy says, yeah, stable. And I said, jump up and down. Now they really look at me weird, but they jump up and down and it looks stable enough. And so I said, stay there, somebody may need your help. And I went to remove their, when they jumped up and down, there was a paving block near the bottom on top of the tires had been blown out by the pressure. They had literally exploded. And so the tire wheel was down here and on top of it, there was a paving block that jiggled. So I went to take the paving block and throw it away so that the president wouldn't step on it. And when I did so, the policeman standing next to me grabbed my hand and said, don't move it, there may be a body part underneath. So I went to Andy and said to Andy, they want to hear the president. He needs to speak to this crowd. Andy immediately said, you're right. That was my idea, it was Nina's idea. And he said, where? And I said, well, he can do it over here. And at that moment, Nina shows up with the bullhorn commandeered from a Con Edison guy and gives it to the president's aide. And at this point, the Latino jumps off the back of the truck. And the 69-year-old retired firefighter, Bob Beckwith, is paying no attention to what's going on. He's just sort of looking out over the crowd. The president makes his way over and puts his hand up, and somebody yells to Bob, and Bob looks down, and all he sees is some guy trying to make his way up this pile of rubble. And so he reaches down and pulls the guy up standing next to him and realizes it's the president of the United States. And completely freaks out. So this is why the president has to sort of throw his arm around him and say, no, you're not going anywhere. And this guy's like, the president. And of course, then there's the famous moment, the colloquy between our guy from Pittsburgh and the president, and the words that no speechwriter had anything to do with. Nobody thought about it in advance. Nobody pre-planned this moment. It just happened. And and when he said it, the wall of noise that had been there before sounded like a whisper compared to what exploded out of that crowd. Karen said she felt sadness. I felt anger that day. I had to fight it. I was so mad at what had happened. And in that moment, you could just hear the anger come out of these iron workers and steel workers and firemen and policemen. I mean, it just came out. They'd seen too many of their comrades and pulled too many bodies from the ashes and seen too many body parts, and they were just angry. But it was like a calming moment when the president said, they're going to hear from us. It was reassuring to people.
I agree with you, Carl. There was such anger there. I remember the horror and the sadness. But at the end, as our motorcade left the city that night, what a powerful sense of inspiration. I don't know if you remember, but we left and it was dark after we left the Javis Center. And there were thousands of New Yorkers lining the streets, and they were holding candles, and they were shouting thank you to the volunteers and God bless America. And it was such a powerful feeling. I just remember leaving the city with 12, such amazing inspiration.
Yeah, 10 and 12 deep. It really was remarkable.
We end with President Bush's own words from his memoir, Decision Points.
September the 11th redefined sacrifice. It redefined duty, and it redefined my job. The story of that week is the key to understanding my presidency. There were so many decisions that followed, many of them controversial and complex. Yet after 9/11, I felt my responsibility was clear. For as long as I held office, I could never forget what happened to America that day. I would pour my heart and soul into protecting the country, whatever it took.
Our thanks to Karen Hughes, Clay Johnson, and Karl Rove, and to President Bush and all of those who have helped to protect our country since the devastating attacks on 9/11. I'm Mark Updegrove. See you next time.